welcome to another episode of the Dying Sports Podcast on the Dying Sports Podcast Network. Today, we've got two great guests coming your way. Up first, we sit down with Michaela Schreider from TSN 1200 to break down the WNBA playoffs, which kick off tonight with a single game elimination series. We preview every playoff matchup, build our brackets, and try and predict who's going to come out on top when all is said and done in the 2021 WNBA playoffs. Then we've got Jake Ellenbogen from the Downtown Rams to talk about all things Los Angeles Rams. Obviously, some huge signings in the offseason and trades. Matthew Stafford now under center in Los Angeles. Some huge predictions coming out of sports media and NFL circles these days. Just how far can the Rams go this season? So he walks us through various positions on the team and what's changed from this version of Sean McVay and the Los Angeles Rams versus the team that we saw lose to the Patriots in the Super Bowl. So very, very cool episode. Before we get to them, though, I want to remind everyone, head over to DinesPressBox.com and check out some of the articles and content that our team is pumping out there daily. Videos, podcasts, articles, and more. Lots of great sports content to keep you in the loop with all the latest news from your favorite leagues across the globe. So be sure to check that out today. Without further ado, let's get right to it. TSN 1200's Michaela Schreider. Joining us today on the podcast, host of She's Got Game, TSN 1200's Michaela Schreider. Michaela, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Kyle. How are you?
I'm doing well. You take a little time off from the Pods versus Pros League. Your fantasy football team, how is your squad faring these days?
So I believe I'm about to be 1-1, depending on how things go tonight. As we record this, it's Monday night, so we still got one more game. But I started the season a little slow, 0-1. Full disclosure, I am the worst fantasy sports player. Like, any sport, doesn't matter. I just never seem to get it. I'll do fantasy hockey or fantasy football like once every couple of years. And because there's being a fan and then there's being like a fantasy sports player, right? Like, there's two different, you're looking at the game differently. You're looking at it in terms of how many reps someone's going to get or how many touches someone's going to get. And I'm just like, well, they had a really great season last year, so let's see. So I never do well. I'm happy to be included and I'm really enjoying it. Like, I do love like putting my team together and all that stuff, but my expectations are very low because the bar is so low for me.
Well, there you go then. So we'll maybe circle back one of the weeks that we actually play each other and we'll see if we can make it a little bit spicy with the side wager. But yeah, we're 2 weeks in and so far so good for our squad. We had the inter-show showdown for the Dynasty League. So my co-hosts have a team, I have a team. So we went head to head there. So
I won
some beer off of them, but it came right down to the wire. There was a late fumble in the Kansas City game last night that swung it. So I just nearly squeaked past him. So
good times.
But that's not what we're here to actually talk about. we're here to talk about WNBA and the playoffs, which are kicking off this Thursday. So off the top, I mean, there's lots that we're going to get into actual series-wise, but there were a couple interesting storylines that also sort of shaped up as the season came to a close. The biggest one would be who was going to actually get that eighth seed, and lo and behold, ended up being a three-way tie. So you got the New York Liberty, you had Washington, you had Los Angeles, all identical records. New York ends up advancing via tiebreaker because of head-to-head records between the clubs. Now, this is a team, though, in New York that was 2-20 last year. So to go from that to a playoff team, the simple answer is, well, Sabrina was healthy this year, but there's more to it than just that. So aside from her being healthy, what did you really see as a difference between last year's gong show of a team versus this year's now playoff team in New York?
Yeah, I mean, Sabrina is definitely a factor, right? Like, Sabrina Ionescu, first overall pick in 2020, the first overall pick that the New York Liberty ever had. She was kind of the savior that was going to fix this franchise. And evidently her services were very needed. Apologies, those are my dogs. Evidently her services were very much needed because she got hurt in her very first season and the team was just terrible, like you mentioned. This is a team that is incredibly young. Right? Sabrina is still their star. She had a healthy season, thank God, but she's still young and she had her moments this year. The identity of the New York Liberty was if anything, inconsistent this year. They started off really hot. Sabrina had like a, not quite a buzzer beater, but I think she hit like a 3-pointer to win the game with 0.4 seconds left or something in the first game. And that kind of set the tone for the first few games, but then they got kind of cold. They'd get hot again. They got kind of cold. So they were streaky throughout the year, as is often the identity of a young team, because that's, you know, the players still haven't figured out how to be professionals in this league. They're still getting themselves figured out. DD Richards is also their, I don't want to say the big star of this year, but she was a very highly touted pick in last year's draft. She had a great tournament with Baylor in the NCAA championships last year, probably one of the better defensive players of the tournament. And so a lot of expectations on her. And, you know, I think they kind of just scraped together enough of a season to squeak into the playoffs. Like you said, like it literally couldn't have been more close than it was. And I think that was just like the, you know, sum of a rather inconsistent season, but one that they also capitalized on the fact that the teams that they were competing against, you know, Washington was without Elena Deladon until a couple of weeks ago. So imagine what would have happened if she were healthy all season and she could play the full season. So I think New York had a bit of luck go in their favor, but you know, this is a very young team. This is a team that has a very bright future. So to get a playoff berth and to get Sabrina some playoff reps, or at least one game, we'll find out early on, I think is a good thing. But for me in New York, it's like, it's the future. It's not right now. It's nice that they're in, but it's the future for them, because they're going to be a really, really good team for a couple of years.
Yeah, there's a little sampler platter there. You know, get yourself a couple of reps and build off it for the future. But it would be a hell of a run if they won the championship. But I don't think they're getting any very good odds on many sports books to hoist the championship trophy when all is said and done there.
No, might have to wait a little bit for that.
Yeah, exactly. Now, very close to New York, you've got the opposite end of the spectrum in the Connecticut Sun, who finished the season on a 14-game winning streak, number one overall seed heading into the playoffs. But they get rewarded as a result by getting byes into the semifinals. So are you a proponent of, to borrow a phrase from our good friend Guy Boucher here in Ottawa, rest is a weapon? Or would you be a little bit concerned about maybe some rust after a longer layoff when they actually hit the court again?
Yeah, it's that second round bye that can be like, I understand one bye week, one bye game, whatever it may be, you know, rewarding the teams at the top with a little bit of a rest, I think is a great thing. But we all know in any sport, it's those teams that just scrape in that are sometimes the dangerous ones, because they've been playing playoff basketball for the last few weeks. And, you know, I would say that could be a factor here, but because the Connecticut Sun are on such a hot streak right now, it's like, well, you know, you could argue that they're in that same position that a just made it into the playoffs team would be, because they've been so hot to end the regular season. And they've also been really good all season. It's not like they were in the basement and then they went on this crazy run. Like, they've got some of the best players on their team, with Jonquel Jones in particular. And they're a fantastic team top to bottom. So they got hot at the right time. I would be a little worried if I'm them, like, taking away some of that momentum because they were so hot. They were on such a hot streak to now be off for, granted, it is two games because of the single game elimination rounds, but, you know, that's a lot of playoff basketball that's going to happen between now and when you step on the court. So I'd be a little concerned, but I think the Connecticut Sun have done everything they can, at least to mitigate that, by being just so damn hot to end the season.
Yeah. And I mean, building off what you're saying there too, for those that are listening that might not be familiar with how the WNBA sort of playoff bracket shapes up, essentially top eight make the playoffs. Top two get byes to the semifinals. Then you get 3 and 4 get byes to the quarters, and then 5 and 8 play single elimination games. So you get this weird sort of pyramid, and it's a mix of both single elimination games and five game best of five series. So obviously 5 plays 8, 6 plays 7, winners move on, and then they play the 3 and 4, and then the winners of that move on to play 1 and 2. Do you like this format off the top, or do you think it could be tweaked one way or another where, no, I'm a purist, I like series right from the get-go, it should be 1 versus 8, or screw it, let's go March Madness style and the whole thing's single elimination?
kind of somewhere in the middle. Like, I like a single game elimination round to get the playoffs started, kind of like the wild card in the MLB. Like, that's really exciting to kick things off right away. And there's nothing more exciting than the first round of any playoffs, whether it's the NHL, the NFL, doesn't matter. Week one is always super exciting. So I don't have an issue with the single game elimination round there. In the second round, I do question, like, why? Why do you need that, right? Like, it could potentially be, in this case, you know, it might be the Seattle Storm versus the Chicago Sky, hypothetically. I want five games of that, mm-hmm. right? Like, the WNBA has never been hotter right now. The interest in women's basketball has never been bigger. Now's the time to start growing that playoff format, because you know there's an appetite to watch it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to keep the single game elimination round for the first round, great. Get people into it, get people excited right away. But then you want to expand it from there, because if we have to watch, for example, a single game elimination of the Seattle Storm, you know, that's not going to go over well for a lot of WNBA fans who are watching for Sue Bird or Breonna Stewart, not to name names, because obviously I'm not one of them. But, you know, these are your marketable stars. This is one of the, and this is just one example, right? The Minnesota Lynx are also a team that could be potentially playing one game and out in the second round. And I don't think you want to have two of your best teams. Yeah, they were 3-4, but they're still two of the best teams in the league. You really want to have them play one game and out? Like, it's not a way to market your sport. I think that format, and admittedly, like, you know, having only been watching the WNBA for a couple of years now, like, maybe this format served them before. Now is the time to expand it, because you want more basketball. People want it.
Absolutely. And I think that's just a case of they need to adapt with the times, as you say. Mm-hmm. Before, probably was a bit of a, let's say, television or promotional crunch, as far as we can only give you so many slots. So are you really going to have 7-game or 5-game series in the first round that people might not be tuning in? Obviously, you got expenses you got to pay for here. Made sense then. And there were probably less teams, all of that good stuff. But now, as you said, it would almost make more sense to develop even the NBA model here, where NBA usually uses NBA G League and all of that to test out their theories and make tweaks here and see whether they want to bring it into the promotion. This could actually be a case of the WNBA almost using the NBA as the guinea pig here, where they had the play-in tournament, right? So let's take top 10 and do 10 versus 7 and 8 versus 9. That is how you get your bottom two seeds to actually move on. Everyone else gets that sort of first round bye. And then everyone, let's just go straight to series, as you say, because people want to watch these games for sure. And there's a massive appetite for it.
That's just it, right? And I love that idea, again, of keeping some sort of play-in round. It is exciting. It is kind of the model that a lot of leagues are going towards. So I think sports fans in general are primed for that. But yeah, the days of, you know, the WNBA, I think, having a hard time selling themselves to broadcasters, I think, are behind us. The numbers speak for themselves. Viewership is only going up. Now's the time to start, you know, second round, 5-7 game series, whatever it may be. That's where your fans are starting to expect those. Because it's also hard to get rivalries going with one game, right? Like, you want that potential game 5 or game 7 or potential sweep or whatever. Like, that's how rivalries develop. You want those longer series. So I think now's the time for the WNBA to start exploring that.
Yeah, everyone remembers where they were during the, you know, Pistons Bulls rivalry series during
exactly.
The Lakers. There's only so much hate you can really develop for someone over the course of one game that doesn't really translate to playoff basketball and those lasting memories that people are, the league is trying to develop, fans for life, right? So they need something to latch onto. So WNBA commissioners, if you're listening to this right now, there's a couple free ideas from your friends in Ottawa.
There you go.
All right, let's get to the meat of it here. So we've got our matchup. So as mentioned, we've got a couple of single game eliminations right off the hop. New York Liberty just squeak in via tiebreaker, and they've got the Phoenix Mercury in the first round, winner take all. Now, do you see any roadmap where the New York Liberty defeat my Phoenix Mercury? I've been a fan for all of, I think I'm going on like 4 or 5 months now here, but do you see any roadmap for them knocking off Taurasi and crew?
I really don't. Again, this is where the one game thing really comes in. Cause hey, there are some times where a single game elimination can be a flip of the coin. but that would have to be a heavily weighted coin for it to tip in the New York Liberty's favor. Like I said earlier, like this is a young team who has a very bright future. It's just not right now. They squeaked into the playoffs and they're going up against, albeit she is hurt right now, Diana Taurasi, who is one of the greatest players of all time, Brittany Griner, who is also included in that 25 WNBA list of 25 best players of all time, Kian Nurse, Skylar Diggins-Smith. Like, these are players who not only have been in the league for a while, have established themselves, but this season in particular have learned to play together with and without each other. Diana Taurasi was hurt for about a month at one point with a fractured sternum. And Skylar Diggins-Smith really stepped up and you know, carried this team to a very consistent record without their star. And, you know, with Taurasi back, potentially, assuming she's going to be healthy for the game, I'm pretty sure even a fractured sternum couldn't keep Taurasi out of a single game elimination. And then, you know, you add to that the superpower of Brittany Griner. She just won a gold medal with Taurasi and Team USA. She's one of the best players in the league by far, and one of the best players of all time as well. You know, 6-time WNBA All-Star, 2-time WNBA Defensive Player of the Year. There's not a lot, like, with all due respect to the New York Liberty and the offensive firepower that they could potentially have with Sabrina Ionescu in particular, I can't see them going up against a defensive player like Brittany Griner and getting past it. So I'm giving this one to Phoenix. Here's hoping for a very entertaining game, because again, you never know what can happen in a single game, but your Phoenix Mercury have got my vote for this one.
Love it. That's music to my ears there. So the only thing I really need to worry about is Sabrina channels her inner Kobe Bryant and has like an 81-point performance or something ridiculous like that.
There you go. Yeah, you never know.
Never know. All right. On the other side of the bracket, also single game elimination, we got Dallas versus Chicago. That one is a little bit more could go either way versus the New York series that we just talked about. Which way are you leaning on that one?
Yeah, this is an interesting matchup. My heart is with the Chicago Sky, and mostly because of Candace Parker. Mm-hmm. Again, similar situation to Taurasi. She was out for a good chunk. I think it was 3 or 4 weeks at the beginning of the season with an ankle injury, and the Chicago Sky struggled without her. But then she came back and they went on a tear with her back on the team. This was her first season, quote unquote, back home in Chicago. She did grow up in Chicago. She was with LA for 13 years. And then, you know, the big free agent move this past offseason. So she's motivated. She wants to win there. She's the Defensive Player of the Year for 2020. She's been very, very hot this season. There doesn't seem to be a lot of slowing her down. And then, you know, you add to that, they also have Allie Quigley and Courtney Vandersloot. It's not like Candace Parker is there by herself. Diamond to Shields as well. Like, there's a lot of talent on the Chicago Sky team. And they have shown at times this season that they can roll with the best of them. In particular, they had a fantastic game against my Seattle Storm, which broke my heart, but was probably one of the best games, one of the best regular season games from this year. And Chicago beat them. And at the time, I think Seattle was on a really, really hot streak and a really good hot streak. And they managed to not only roll with them, but to walk away with the win. So, you know, Dallas is certainly no slouches. They do have Arika Ogunbowale, who took home the WNBA All-Star Game MVP. She's had herself a great season so far. They got Charlie Collier, who was the first overall pick in this last the 2021 draft. Again, the Dallas Wings might also be in a little bit of that situation. Same with New York Liberty, where their future is bright, but is now the time? You know, does Charlie Collier have the experience to help them in the playoffs? Who knows? So I'm giving the edge to Chicago, but this is definitely one of those games where I wouldn't be surprised to see it go either way.
So far, we're in complete agreement because
good. Our brackets are the same.
Yeah, our brackets are the same. So we'll see in the next round whether there's going to be any kind of disagreements. And I have a feeling there's going to be a disagreement on one of them, but we'll get to that in a sec. So assuming Chicago and Phoenix move on, that would put Chicago against Minnesota in round two. So again, another single game elimination. Minnesota, obviously, our girl from the booming metropolis of Chatham, Ontario there. We've got Bridget Carleton with Minnesota. do you think chalk rocks here and Minnesota moves on, or do you smell maybe an opportunity for an upset?
No. So yeah, this is where it gets interesting, because, you know, I talked about Candace Parker and how motivated she is for this year. So it's hard to bet against someone who not only is at the point in their career where they have perspective, they know, you know, I'm not saying she's necessarily nearing retirement here, but she's definitely on the back half of her career. I've never seen someone as motivated as Candace Parker is right now. And like I said, the Chicago Sky just have that potential of rolling with any superstar team they go up against. But the Minnesota Lynx, I also think that there have been times this year where they've been one of the best teams in the league. They just inched Seattle out of that third overall spot. And we all know the kind of superstar power that Seattle Storm have. So it's hard to go against the Minnesota Lynx just with everything they've done this year, not to mention Sylvia Fowles is arguably, a lot of people would make a case that she is the best player in the WNBA right now. And she's having herself a season with Minnesota. So it's hard to go against them, but it's also hard to go against Candace Parker right now. I think she's an X factor for the Chicago Sky. So I'm hard pressed to give like a definitive winner of this series quite yet. I think I'd need to see how the Sky play in the first round, but has the potential to be a very interesting matchup.
Yeah, I think that'll definitely be a very, very closely contested one. Probably going to come down to maybe even who has the ball last. And who knows? It's Minnesota's very, very strong team. Again, they've been solid throughout the season. They haven't had any extended losing streaks or anything crazy like that. And just a very consistent team, balanced scoring. They don't lean on one player to carry the entire squad. So it's going to be interesting. But again, I think we'll get a real sense for it in that Dallas-Chicago series as far as how much do they have left in the tank? Can they move on? Can they make this a deep run and Candace Parker is going to be legitimately vying for another WNBA championship? Or is it going to be, like we said, chalk rocks here in Minnesota as the third overall seed is going to move on? So I'm going to lean towards Minnesota here. I have a feeling we're probably going to disagree on the next one, because if Phoenix beats the Liberty, that means they would be meeting your Seattle Storm. So attempting to put aside your love for all things Bird, for all things Stewart, for all things Seattle, how do you see this series playing out? Aside from it being probably one of the most exciting matches of the entire playoffs, especially given the fact that it's a single game elimination too.
And that's just it. And here is a further argument of why we need at least five games in the second round, because you've got GOAT versus GOAT, you know, Diana Taurasi versus Sue Bird potentially, and you're going to give us one game of that? Are you kidding me? Removing my bias, I do think that you're absolutely right. This has the potential to be one of the best games in the playoffs, right? GOAT versus GOAT, Taurasi versus Bird. Sue Bird would tell you that Diana Taurasi is the greatest player of all time. Diana Taurasi would probably tell you the same thing. Yeah. And you know, they're best friends, and we watched them win their fifth Olympic gold medal together, and now we get to watch them go head to head in the playoffs. Like, that is just, you could not pay for that kind of entertainment. The thing with the Seattle Storm is, as powerful as they are and as dominant as they can be, they have struggled a little bit this season. And it's not so much, I think that they also just happen to, you know, with the Connecticut Sun and the Minnesota Lynx having the seasons they did, like, you just can't, no matter how good you are, these two teams have been at times just crazy dominant. So the fact that Seattle was in the fourth spot, I think, is less of a detriment to them and more of a testament to their competitors. But, you know, you got Breonna Stewart, who didn't finish the regular season with an ankle injury. She's had a busy year herself. Not only did she win an Olympic gold and a Commissioner's Cup, but she became a mom. So, you know, she's had a lot going on in her life, and now she's dealing with an injury. So I've no doubt that she has the ability to rebound. She's a professional athlete. No doubt in my mind she can come back, but, you know, will she be coming back a little rusty because she didn't get to play in the end of the regular season? You know, is she even going to be back? We haven't received confirmation on that, I don't believe. Jewel Lloyd has done a fantastic job of stabilizing this team. When Breonna Stewart was out, she had a fantastic game actually to finish off the season against the Phoenix Mercury. So, you know, again, removing my bias, I do think that if Breonna Stewart is healthy, or at least healthy enough to play to even close to the Breonna Stewart level that we're used to seeing, I do give the upper hand to Seattle. But in a single elimination game, anything is possible. And the Phoenix Mercury are a fantastic team. I talked about Diana Taurasi. I talked about Brittany Griner. This is a team that if I'm the Seattle Storm, I wouldn't want to be going up against. And unfortunately we are. So this is definitely one of those games that, yeah, you could see it coming down to who has the ball last, or, you know, however long it's going to go. I feel like this has the potential to be one of the most interesting games of the playoffs.
Absolutely. And I mentioned it before, it's a single game elimination. It's going to ramp the intensity up, and it'll probably become an instant classic, assuming that it does come down to a closely contested game. And a lot of that will also factor into, is Miss Stewart going to come back fully healthy? Is she going to come back 85%, 50%? Who knows? So they're playing it very tight to the chest right now, as far as any kind of information about her. Who knows? So we probably won't know until we see during warmups. Is she hobbling around? Is she looking like her old self? I don't think there's going to be too many leaks coming out of Seattle these days, but I couldn't have said it any better myself. This is why you have multiple playoff rounds rather than multiple single elimination games here, because people want to see this as a playoff series. Could you imagine? Yeah. Let's put aside the fact that, yeah, single game elimination, a little bit exciting. You know what's even more exciting? After four games of back and forth, it's split 2-2, and now it's a single elimination game, game five, and we've got all of this buildup to it, right? Like, this is what makes playoff classics. So it's a little bit disappointing that we're getting this in the second round. I was really hoping Minnesota didn't leapfrog Seattle, and we could have potentially had some pathways to them maybe meeting in the finals, but it's happening there. I mean, you're going to go homer, so I'm going to go homer. So I'm going to take the Phoenix Mercury to move
on. There you
go. First disagreement of the day.
Really, we'll put a wager on it. We'll make it interesting. Someone will get beer.
There we go. Perfect. That sounds good to me.
To make an argument in your favor as well, Kia Nurse had one of her best games of her career against the Seattle Storm earlier this year. So maybe she's got something special lined up for this one again. Who knows?
One can hope. That would be great. I wouldn't be disappointed in that at all. All right. So that would bring us to the semifinals, where, by the way, the Connecticut Sun and the Las Vegas Aces have just been sitting here this whole time. They are waiting.
Still there.
Who is going to actually even be their opponent? So, regardless of what happens in either of our scenarios, that would mean Connecticut against either Seattle or Phoenix, and then Las Vegas against Minnesota, because Vegas gets the high seed. Let's start with Vegas versus Minnesota. Two high-powered offenses. Bit of a difference in contrast and style of play, though. How do you see this one shaping up if we see them in a semifinal matchup?
Yeah, this one has the potential to be very, very interesting, because like you said, there's two very different styles here, and Las Vegas really rides heavy on that high-powered offense. Like, Asia Wilson is, I keep saying this about players, but she is one of the best players in the league. You know, reigning MVP, she's having herself another great season. So I feel like, you know, that you've got the high-powered offense versus the kind of more, I don't want to say subtle, but like just evenly spread out Minnesota Lynx that don't, you mentioned earlier, they don't have one player you need to target. They don't have one player who's going to kill you. They have five on the court at any one time who could do this. And, you know, I mentioned Sylvia Fowles. Again, she is, a lot of people think that she should be taking home the MVP for this season. So this is one of those matchups that, like, it could work. It could create an incredibly entertaining game, or it could go in like heavy favor of one team, right? It's all going to depend on the how the series, because this is finally when we're going to see a five game series instead of a single game elimination. So, you know, how you would think that a team like Minnesota is kind of better built for those longer series, because they're going to wear you down and they're going to consistently, they're not going to go away. Whereas, you know, a team like Vegas, and not to downplay them by any means, because they have a second round or third round bye for a reason, but, you know, you could potentially target a couple of their players and shut them down pretty easily. Whereas Minnesota, that's much more difficult. So in a five game series, I would honestly give the I would probably tip it in favor of Minnesota, but that's also going to depend on how their first two games go, right? Like what happens in those two games? Do we have any injuries? Are they worn down? So that'll be a really interesting matchup for sure.
That's exactly it, right? You've got evenly balanced scoring versus relying pretty heavily on one or two players in Vegas. Now, mind you, it helps that they're all world players in Vegas that they're leaning on. It's not like they're expecting to get filet mignon out of dog kibble or anything here. It's going to be who imposes their will the most. Who can dictate the flow of the game? Is it going to be a slower, more deliberate half-court sets and all that? Or is it going to be the run-and-gun frenetic style of play that Las Vegas kind of likes to do and kill you in transition and fast breaks and all of that? It's the classic case of, and if you ever played basketball and went to any AAU tournaments or competitive tournaments or anything like that growing up, it's the case of here we've got the team that everyone expects to win versus that team that they don't have any all-world talent, but they're going to press you. They're going to, you know, make you fight for every single inch. They're the team that's really annoying to play against for some of those really high-level athletes. And so I think it's going to come down to, does Las Vegas allow Minnesota to get under their skin, and do they let them slow the game down a little bit? Because if they do, they could be in trouble. If they're able to play to their strengths and rely on, like I said, that transition game a little bit more, I see them coming out on top and maybe not even particularly close in that series, like maybe 3-1 or even 3-0. But again, if Minnesota wins, I'm going to say Minnesota wins in five. If Vegas wins, I say they win in, I'll say they win in four, just so I have one little blip that I can rely on. But gun to my head, if I have to pick only one, I'll say Vegas does it. I think that they get it done and move on to the final. So that would mean, again, in either of the scenarios here, Mercury or Seattle against Connecticut, which begs the million-dollar question, can anyone dethrone Connecticut this year, or is this just the Suns' year to hoist the championship trophy?
It might just be that, like, sometimes, you know, we spend all this time and effort into predicting things going sideways in the playoffs, and sometimes they just play out exactly how you think. Yeah. And this feels like one of those seasons. It's just, it seems so effortless for Connecticut at times this season. They have been consistently, like, from day one, the best team in this league, and they finished the regular season so unbelievably hot. The only thing I could see going against them, like we talked about earlier, is like you've got to watch two rounds of basketball go by before you even get to play a game. And then in that game, are you going up against Sue Bird or Diana Taurasi? Like, pick your poison. Yeah. But I think that's what they want. I think they're a team that they've played really well against Seattle this season. And I haven't paid quite as much attention to how they've fared against Mercury, but they seem to be that team that they know a lot of people are going to discount them, you know, just in any other season. It's never the Connecticut Sun show. It's always the Phoenix Mercury. It's always the Seattle Storm. It's the Chicago Sky. Like, you know, they're the bigger markets, and Connecticut has just been silently all season being the best team in this league by a country mile at times. And like I said, with Jonquel Jones, she just had an amazing season. Even when she went out for a couple games and they were able to consistently still play well, and they didn't just rely on her. They had other players to kind of pick up the slack. So I honestly don't see anybody beating Connecticut going into these playoffs. I think this is their championship to lose. Again, it's all going to depend on how do they use those two rounds. I know it's only two games, but two rounds that they're off. Are they able to use it to their advantage, or does it become a little bit of rust? So that remains to be seen. But I truly believe this is Connecticut's championship to lose.
Yeah, and I'm of the exact same opinion. I don't think it particularly matters whether it is going to be the Storm or the Mercury who they face. I think the writing's kind of on the wall that they're at the worst case scenario. I can see maybe in the championship game, they somehow lose in a closely contested five-game series. I just don't see, with how they played all season long and how hot they were down the stretch, them bowing out anywhere before the championship game. And like you said, it's just might be one of those years where you can try and come up with a narrative that, well, if all the stars align and this, 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 and this happens, and like, to be honest, unless there's a bus crash and half the team gets injured on the way to the stadium, like I really just don't see many ways that they get bounced before the finals. So unfortunately, this is where my homerism ends, and I'm actually going to have to take Connecticut to move on to the championship game. But I mean, I hope that we at least get a very, very entertaining, I guess it would be second round series between the Storm and the Mercury. And that one might actually be even more entertaining than this semifinal matchup, even though it goes five games. So hopefully we get a little bit of good stuff out of that one, at least before either one of our teams potentially bows out.
And just to think of, like, you know, to really steer into the fact that we're both homers here, to talk about the Phoenix Mercury Seattle Storm potential matchup, like, this could be Sue Bird or Diana Taurasi's. I don't think it's either of their last seasons. We know Diana Taurasi's going to see us in Paris, but you know, this could be the last time they meet each other in the playoffs. This could be the last playoffs for either one of them. You don't know. And again, I keep hammering home this point, but good God, we need five games of this, please. To think we're only going to get one is heartbreaking. But like that puts that much more weight on this potential matchup, because, you know, when you've got two superstars like Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi who are nearing the end of their career, any moment could be the last one, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes it that much special, much more special and much more fun to watch. But it puts that much more weight on it too. So I really, really hope that's what we're seeing in the second round. We'll make a wager, we'll make it interesting, but I've got that circled on my calendar for sure.
Yeah. Well, if I pull on that thread just a little bit further there, let's say everything lines up perfectly and either one of those teams, whether it's the Mercury or the Storm, end up winning the championship this year. Do you think that either Taurasi or Bird go out on the mountaintop and say, you know what, I've got nothing left to prove. Like, what more do I have to go and accomplish? Won the championship, I'm going to call it a career. Or do you think both are probably coming back next season, come hell or high water?
Oh my God, it hurts to even think about it. I think Diana Taurasi is coming back no matter what. She almost defiantly does not want to retire anytime soon. Sue Bird is much more vague about it. Like, even at the Olympics, she said, this is my last Olympics. And when she talks about her career and whether or not she's nearing retirement, she's very much a politician and doesn't really answer the question, which makes me nervous. And they have been doing a little bit of load management with her, and they often have throughout her career, but you know, she'll often not play the entire third quarter, and they've been managing her minutes quite a bit, but she still has a better 3-point percentage this year than she has at any point in her career. Like, she's playing great. It's not like she's slowed down. She's still, you know, you watch her pass the ball. No one passes the ball better than Sue Bird at this point. So, you know, from a, obviously as a fan and a wanter to retire, it doesn't look like she's slowing down, but in terms of how she's feeling, who knows? I could see Sue Bird retiring before Diana Taurasi, just based on the way that they've handled interviews and answered questions. But, you know, if we're looking at both of these athletes, and then you look at their respective teams, like, not only are both of them are still playing great basketball, but they're not as heavily relied on their teams because there's other stars that they can lean on. So I also think they're kind of in that perfect situation of, this is where you want to kind of ride out the remainder of your career, where you're not the one who needs to put up big minutes and big numbers, but you're consistently there. You support your team, your leadership. This is where your leadership really comes in. So it pains me to say it. I would give it to Sue Bird to retire first, but I honestly don't think I could see either one of them retiring after this year.
We'll have to go online and check when the next mayor of Seattle election is coming up. It might very well run for that. That might be the only thing that gets her to finally retire from the WNBA. But
yeah, and she'd win.
She'd win. Landslide. All right, that brings us to a finals then of potentially either Vegas or Minnesota against the Connecticut Sun. Are we both in agreement here that Connecticut's going to run away with it, or are you going to come up with a curveball out of left field? Ooh. One of them upsets Connecticut in the finals.
I'm going to be boring and say Connecticut again. I think this is their championship to lose. But that being said, I wouldn't be overly surprised if Vegas or Minnesota gave them a run for their money, right? Like, but we talked about why both teams are fantastic. Minnesota has that longevity playoff style of basketball, so I could see them making it real difficult. And Vegas has the firepower and enough of an offense that they could easily make this. They could throw a curveball themselves, right? And so much of this is going to depend on what did the playoff what did the playoffs look like for these potential three teams, right? Like, depending on if it's Vegas or Minnesota, you know, did they get beat up? Are they tired? Did they sail through and they're riding this hot momentum? And, you know, Connecticut had to sit on the sidelines for a little bit. So I think a lot of it's going to depend on how the playoffs shake out for all of them. But yeah, I'm giving it to Connecticut this year. I really do think this is their year.
Well, we took different paths to get there, but we wound up at the same conclusion. I'm of the exact same opinion. I think Connecticut, it's theirs to lose. If they don't win it, I would be more surprised than anyone else. So, I mean, there's not much that we haven't already said about it. They're just too deep, too balanced. They seem to be peaking at the right time. The only scenario I see is that all of a sudden, somehow, that longer layoff comes back to haunt them a little bit, and suddenly they find themselves maybe in a 1-0 or 2-0 hole before they get their feet under them, and then they kind of claw back to make it a series, and then it does come down to a coin flip where, hey, something weird happens and suddenly the other team goes on a third quarter run and they find themselves down 12 heading into the fourth. Like, but that's a lot of dominoes that would need to fall sequentially for them to find themselves in that hole, and I just don't see it happening. So I'm going same with you. Connecticut Sun are going to be your 2021 WNBA champions. Any prediction for finals MVP, if that's the case?
Ooh, I'm going to, you know, I know I've said her name several times throughout this podcast, but probably Jonquel Jones. I can, if Connecticut wins, it's probably going to be because they're riding heavy with her, or there's like a huge upset and like someone from Minnesota or Vegas wins. So no, I think we'll probably see Jonquel Jones take it. It feels like her time.
All right. Well, Michaela, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us tonight. We appreciate it as always. We'll circle back if that Phoenix versus Seattle matchup does indeed end up happening there and have to put some sort of wager on the line.
I'm into it.
Where can people tune in to find you when they're not listening to you on the Dine Sports podcast?
So they can find me on across the TSN radio network on She's Got Game, which is a weekly show that focuses entirely on women's sports. So you can head over to your local TSN radio website, TSN 1200 in Ottawa, for example, and check out She's Got Game. All of our episodes are podcasted there. And then you can find me on Twitter at Shrides, Shreids. I like to spell it because no one ever knows how to spell Shrides. So
there you go. You don't need to fumble around aimlessly on Twitter. You can just find it right there with that spelling. Love
there
it.
There you go.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll see what happens after the Thursday night games, but we'll have an answer one way or another. And hopefully Sabrina doesn't dethrone our entire plans for that second round matchup.
No, obviously. Thank you so much for having me, Kyle. This is great.
Before we get to Jake's interview, want to remind everyone to go check out our sponsors over at mybookie.ag. MyBookie has some of the friendliest sports betting lines across the internet. A little bit of something for everyone, whether you're into futures bets, parlays, single game money lines, or more, they've got you covered. Make sure to use the promo code DINESports, D-Y-N-E-S, sports with an S at the end of it, when signing up, making a top-up deposit, or more. Lots of first deposit bonuses that you can claim as well too. As always, if you want to follow along with us, our parlay of the week, because we're talking WNBA and NFL, figure why not bet on both of those that are going on tonight. So we are going to take the Phoenix Mercury money line to defeat the New York Liberty in their first round matchup. And on Thursday night football, we are going to take the Carolina Panthers to defeat the Houston Texans. So Mercury and Panthers tonight. If you don't like that, do your own thing over there, but make sure to use the promo code DINESports. Must be 18 or older, please gamble responsibly. Now we sit down with Jake from Downtown Rams.
Joining us today on the podcast from Downtown Rams, we've got Jake Ellenbogen. Jake, how are you doing today, sir?
Doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, doing well. You've obviously got to be pretty happy as someone who's covering the Rams. Good start to the season, 2-0. What's just the vibe in Rams fandom land these days?
Yeah, you know, I think coming into this season, this is a team that's one of the most winning organizations since 2017. Not surprising, that's when Sean McVay joined the fray. But, you know, to see what they've been able to do with Jared Goff and to go out and get Matthew Stafford, this offseason, who's been my one of my favorite quarterbacks in all of football. I've been watching him a lot, you know, going back to Detroit. And I always say, you know, a lot of people were not ready for what he was going to do with the Rams because they had just seen him on Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think for me, looking at this team and, you know, winning 13 games, their second season with McVay, you know, even at that best point with Goff, he still wasn't really close to what Stafford can be in this offense. So I'm very high on the Rams. You know, I had them win the Super Bowl. I don't pick them every year to win the Super Bowl. This year, I just felt like coming in, they really felt like the best team. And it was all because this team has already been a top five team, in my opinion, every year, talent-wise on paper. But you add Stafford, and it's just a whole different feel. And so, yeah, I'm feeling really good about this team. I know it's funny. Rams fans are really not happy about how close that game was. And I've been on like seven different shows this week, and everybody's like, oh, the Rams had a really good win on Sunday. And it's just funny to hear the difference, because the fans expected a blowout, and the non-Rams fans are looking at it as an impressive road win. And I think maybe, you know, we should be looking at more as the latter.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's just it. Fans of some potentially long-suffering franchises, they're never fully enthused with the win unless it is a blowout. But at the end of the day, you're one of the few undefeated teams remaining in the NFL. So that's got to count for something, right?
Absolutely. And then, you know, you go and you're playing against the Super Bowl, defending Super Bowl champions this upcoming, you know, weekend. And, you know, keep in mind the last time they lost was against the Rams. So, you know, it's definitely going to be fun. Probably I've had this penciled in pretty much since we found out about the schedule. This is potentially the game of the year when you really look at it. It's only week three. So there's a chance that the defenses won't be as, you know, they'll be sloppier than usual. They won't be as fine-tuned, especially with the injuries that Tampa has suffered. But when you look at it, these offensive juggernauts, I think it's going to be a incredible battle. And, I mean, those are the two best teams, in my opinion, in football right now. So, you know, them going up against each other week three, we're in for a treat.
You already touched on it, but obviously massive, massive deal this offseason, sending Goff to Detroit for Stafford. Now, they're both professionals and, you know, they've said all the right things in the media, but did you get the sense that McVay and Goff was just a fractured relationship towards the end? And whether it was Stafford coming in or another quarterback via trade or free agency or whatever, that one way or another, at the end of last season, Goff was out of town come hell or high water?
Yeah, you know, I just really felt like Jared Goff, once John Wolford came in for the injured Jared Goff in week 17 and started that game, John Wolford could have played horribly. And Sean McVay still would have been like, okay. So that was a different way to play call with a mobile quarterback. It was different to feel, you know, I could run for 40 yards if need be. This guy could roll out and run the bootleg to perfection. He could make a little Russell Wilson light type of, you know, play to him, breaking tackles or slipping out of tackles. And, you know, I mean, John Wolford was really fun to watch in week 17. Was really excited to see him get going against Seattle because he was going to start the playoff game. And then, you know, we won't get too into it. I do think Jamal Adams had a dirty hit, and originally it was flagged. But that hit was the end of John Wolford's opportunity. So I really felt for him. Goff came in, as everyone knows, won that playoff game, but let's be real here, he could barely throw with the broken thumb. So looking at that, I don't think Sean McVay was looking at it as, oh, glad Jared Goff's back in there. Yeah. I think he was looking at it like, well, this is what we have, and he's gonna start for us next week because John Wolford won't be ready to go, and we'll see if we can beat Green Bay, and if not, I'm already, you know, I'm focused on this season. Once we lose, then I'll be focused on next season. And then sure enough, I thought Goff put an incredible performance together, knowing he's not 100%, knowing he didn't have Cooper Kupp, knowing Aaron Donald was not fully healthy in that one. And by fully healthy, I mean, he was basically 30% healthy. And at Lambeau, which is one of the toughest places to play in the cold, especially in the postseason, I thought he put in a great effort and they had an opportunity. And I think if Donald was healthy, they probably might have ended up winning the game and played Tampa in the NFC title game. But that's not what happened. And so I think because of that, you fast forward. Sean McVay, at this point, you have to think about how much pressure he's under. You go to the playoffs after the team goes 4-12 the first year. So you're Mr. Wonderful. You know, you're Mr. Magical, whatever you want to call it. But at the same time, you lost at home in the playoffs. So there was some of that. Well, you know, he'll be back next year. He's learning. He's a young coach, all of that. But he knew he couldn't just be back next year and lose the same way. So they won some close games. The Dallas game, they end up running over 200 yards rushing combined between Todd Gurley and CJ Anderson. And then they play the New Orleans Saints, go to the Super Bowl. And we already know what happened there. But what's not mentioned enough is how the Rams started off with the most unlucky type of stuff, you know, having a tipped pass off the hands of Gurley, getting picked off, down 10-0 early on, and then just to dominate the whole second half really was impressive on the road in such a tough environment. Then you go to the Super Bowl and you go against New England and Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, and actually pretty much hold Tom Brady to a pedestrian type of game, a really game manager type of role, not what we're seeing now in Tampa. And really comes down to one or two throws, one or two plays being the end of it. But of course, all we hear is, well, McVay, his offense only scored 3 points. Guy isn't all that great. And so, you know, you have that. And then following that, you have the 2019 season where everyone's like, okay, this team still is very talented. They should probably go back to the Super Bowl. And they have what some would call a Super Bowl hangover. I would call some unlucky and unfortunate events, especially with, Todd Gurley, his play going down a cliff due to the injury, and you missed the playoffs. Now, you would have made it in the new 7-team format, but that was the last year of the 6-team format. Yeah. So they missed the playoffs for the first time in Sean McVay's career, although the fact that they they did go 10-6 or 9-7. And, you know, I just think to me, when you look at that, Sean McVay knew 2020 had to be different. He changed things around a little bit, but not enough. And the thing is, this is somebody who doesn't want to be, you know, that coach that is constantly making the playoffs and losing. Like his opportunity here is really, he's changed everything for this organization, but now he needs to realize, and he knows this, that the organization now expects Super Bowls, and you're in LA, you're competing with the Lakers, you're competing with the Dodgers. You know, you have to be able to win championships in order to stay relevant in LA. And especially now with the Chargers, who I also think, you know, they're going to the Super Bowl. But looking at that, Sean McVay saw that, yeah, I mean, maybe we could win a Super Bowl with Jared Goff if everything went perfect. But for the seasons where it doesn't go perfect, the offensive line isn't the best in the league. You know, we have an injury at wide receiver. I need a guy who can work off script, you know, make the off schedule throws, make off platform throws, do anything on the football field to win. And I mean, he's probably been watching Stafford at, you know, with the Lions, because when he became available, the Rams were all over that. And eventually Stafford, which we found out a little bit later on an Ian Rappaport report, is that Stafford kind of steered his way to the Rams. You know, a lot of people felt like, yeah, you know, the Niners were involved and the Colts and you had the Bears. No, they were teams that were interested, but the Niners never made a formal offer. The Jets never made a formal offer. The Panthers are the only team that had an offer. They had Bridgewater and picks, and Stafford denied it. Mm-hmm. So he didn't end up in Carolina. He goes to the Rams because he really kind of forced that. And I mean, when you look at the Rams on paper, it's not the same, but it's like honestly kind of looking at the Broncos. You know, you have that Vic Fangio defense. You have guys like Von Miller. You know, now you have Surtain. You have Bradley Chubb. You have a amazing offensive line. You have Sutton, you have Judy, and you're thinking, wow, the Broncos are really just a quarterback away.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that Teddy Bridgewater's bad quarterback. I'm not going to say that he is a great quarterback or he's not a great quarterback, but he's not Stafford. And the Rams, they were in that pretty much the whole time. And when Goff started to, you know, pretty much show his regression, McVay was pretty much left with no other choice than to go out and get a guy like Stafford. And you don't get an opportunity to get a quarterback like that. So I think that they wanted to pounce on that, because right now, you know, the 49ers, I mean, Kyle Shanahan was on a podcast with him and he was upset that he didn't go out and get him. So we'll see. I mean, in the long term, you look at it, you're like, okay, Stafford is what, 32, 33, 34, what have you. So it doesn't look that brilliant to trade away a 25, 26 year old quarterback. At the same time, how much better is Goff going to get? Because I feel like he's kind of reached that ceiling. Whereas Stafford, he's the same quarterback, but how much better can he produce in this offense? And I think the possibilities are endless. And so the Rams knew that and they made this trade.
Yeah. Well, so far, so good. Early returns on that investment. I mean, Stafford, yeah. 599 yards, 5 TTs, 1 interception through 2 games, obviously 2-0. There have been some bold predictions that have been thrown out there, and Peter King's is getting a lot of heat right now, where he's saying that Stafford could be the first 6,000-yard passer in the history of the league. So how much of that do you think is just people overreacting to, oh, like the Lions were holding Stafford back here with this new offense? It's like getting a Ferrari on the highway. How far can they go? Versus whether that offense is actually capable of putting up those kinds of numbers. Like what sort of ceiling do you put on this Rams offense this season?
Well, I think kind of similar to 2018, you know, when people are like greatest show on turf 2.0, mm-hmm. I still couldn't vibe with that, because while 2018, that team, they definitely, I had them going far in Super Bowl, felt likely going out and getting Aqib Talib and Marcus Peters and Dominican Sue. It felt very likely. This year, it's about what has already been established. They didn't go out and make any marquee free agency signings. You know, the biggest signing they made was DeSean Jackson. The second biggest signing they made, he's with the Packers. They traded him away for late round picks, and that's punter and Corey Bohorquez. Mm-hmm. So they really didn't go out of their way to make these free agency signings. Their offseason was centered around, hey, we like what we have. We'd love to bring back John Johnson, but we unfortunately can't because we've put so much into the safety position. We've drafted 3 safeties over the last 2-3 years, actually 4. And it's like there's no point to paying John Johnson because we don't have that money. And then on top of that, you know, you had guys in the past like Corey Littleton, who played linebacker. They felt like, well, we really like our linebackers, love Littleton. We just can't pay that money. And so this is a team that feels like right now they have everything in place, at least this year. This is going to be a year-to-year team. We're going to see a lot of moves next year. You know, they're going to have to be creative with it because right now they're paying Goff. Goff will be off the books, I believe, next season. So it's interesting because when you think about it, you're looking at, you know, who's available next year, who's a free agent next year. The majority of the offensive line, their contract will expire. Potentially Andrew Whitworth will retire, all of that. So right now we're looking at year to year, but this is a year where I feel like they're bringing this team over from last season with unfinished business. Now, not everybody is the same. Not every starter's the same, but it feels similar to last season because it really is. Mm-hmm. When you look, you know, as far as the starters go, the brand new starters, Brian Allen at center, Austin Blythe lost in free agency. Then you look at the defense and you're like, well, John Johnson's gone, but they replaced him with Taylor Rapp and Jordan Fuller. And then you look at the linebacker and it's like, well, you know, Micah Kizer actually just got picked up by the Denver Broncos off the practice squad. So right now they're rolling with Kenny Young and Troy Reader, but Troy Reader started last year. So really just another, honestly, Kenny Young started towards the end of last season. So really that's not even the case. Then you look at the defensive line, that's really just Michael Brockers being replaced by A'shaun Robinson. And then the outside linebacker, I mean, Justin Hollins kind of established himself as a starter on the outside at the end of last season. So really, there's not a ton of starters that have changed. Cam Akers gets hurt, but you have Daryl Henderson, who was running really well before the injury down the stretch last season. And then you had Stafford. So that's the thing. I think the Rams just feel really good about this. Is pretty much not exactly the same team as last year, but look at how far we got. We got to the divisional round, and then they have to feel like, well, you know, we almost got to the NFC title game, and that was with an injured quarterback, our best player in Aaron Donald, who changes the course of games and how teams defend him and how he opens up opportunities for everyone else around him, was 30% healthy. Now we have health, we have depth, and we have a starting quarterback that is essentially like having Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, because they haven't had a quarterback like that in that offense. But when you have Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods, Van Jefferson, DeSean Jackson, Tyler Higbee, they just had Sony Michel, Daryl Henderson, all these weapons, it really makes it easy. I'm thinking it'd be easier on Goff, but now you have Stafford, who can, he does not just focus on one receiver. He goes through, you know, 3 to 4 reads, it seems like, every play. He just does an incredible job. And sometimes he's not afraid because he knows he has the accuracy, he knows he has the arm strength. He'll hold on to the ball a split second longer than Jared Goff did. And the rewards are just so much more than what Goff did, because we had it last week. I don't know if you saw the game, but it was, they're going down the field. It's 24-24. This drive is so important because it's third down and one at like midfield. If the Rams throw an incompletion here, if they, whatever, they don't get it, it's going to be fourth down, midfield, tough decision to make with around 3 minutes, 2 minutes to go. And, you know, are you punting it back to Indy, giving the ball back to them 24-24 and just having the home, you know, momentum kick in, or what? And we don't know, because they didn't have to make the decision, because Matthew Stafford, the play kind of broke down a little bit. Matthew Stafford hit Cooper Kupp going towards the right sideline. He was getting chased, so he gets a blitz right up the middle, and Stafford is running backwards and kind of just like fading away a little bit. And he like sidearms it, and he puts just enough on it. He waits until the right minute. So Cooper Kupp finishes his break. He gets Cooper Kupp. Kupp gets the ball. He's able to, you know, make a move on Darius Leonard, break his ankles, and get the first down. No one talks about that play, but that might have been the play of the day, because if they don't get that, I mean, I don't know. Do you go for it fourth and inches midfield, knowing that the ball, you'd be giving the ball right back to them at midfield, tie a game and everything? Or do you try? That's the thing. And so those are the things that Matthew Stafford does that Jared Goff did not. And I think last year they had a chance at winning a Super Bowl with Goff. So now this is why, to me, I feel like they're the favorite, because they have pretty much everything in place and they just added somebody that's already so good. It's like, in a sense, he's not as good, but when you look at the NBA, you saw the Golden State Warriors and how they built that team. And then they go out and they get Kevin Durant, and you're like, this isn't fair. It's kind of like that, honestly, is that people don't realize Stafford is in that upper echelon of quarterbacks as far as just pure arm talent. And now here he is going to this team that's just ready.
Yeah. Well, I want to touch on something that you brought up there, because obviously huge blow losing Cam Akers preseason. Now, Rams have accumulated 175 rushing yards through two games. 123 of them are Henderson's. Now, Michelle is in there. Do you put a lot of faith in that Henderson-Michelle 1-2 punch? Do you think that's maybe a weak spot for them? Do you think they may maybe even try and go out and acquire another piece later this season? Like, how much faith do you have in that Henderson-Michelle backfield as a Super Bowl winning potential tailback duo?
Well, you know, I think anything that they have is better than what Stafford's used to. So, you know, keep in mind, he started his last playoff game with Zach Center as his running back. So I think he's fine with any of these guys, even Jake Funk, to be honest with you. But I think the biggest issue here is health. And we don't know what's going to happen. Henderson might play on Sunday, but he did suffer a rib cartilage injury the same week last year that Cam Akers suffered a rib cartilage injury. So really bizarre. I've never even heard of it until last year when Cam Akers suffered it. So we don't even know if he's going to play. It sounds to me like he might, but he'll probably be a little limited. They brought in Sony Michel to be, in my opinion, an 8 to 12 touch guy, whereas Henderson was going to lead 18 to 22, I'd say. They really do like Henderson. And I can't stress that enough, because there's been a lot of people like, well, you know, they got Sony Michel to be the starter. Even, you know, Adam Schefter reported that. And that's not the case. they really got Sony Michel to pretty much emulate the Cam Akers to Daryl Henderson type of 1-2 punch. But in a way, with just the workload, Henderson would have gotten with Akers, because flip-flop this, Akers would have gotten the 18-22 and Henderson would have gotten the 8-12. So if you think about it in terms of body type and everything, emulating what Cam Akers would be in this offense makes a lot of sense with Sony Michel, who is built like Cam Akers. So that's how I looked at that. And I'm not worried about the running game at all. I just finished watching the All 22 and I was just blown away, to be honest with you, how well Brian Allen, their center that they drafted in 2018 in the fourth round, who I did not like to pick initially. He didn't play at all in 2018. 2019, he started, got hurt. 2020, he battled an injury and COVID. And now here he is in 2021 as the starter. And he just did a really nice job against the Bears and Akeem Hicks and Bilal Nichols. But in this one, you know, he went up against guys like Taylor Stallworth. He went up against guys like DeForest Buckner, Grover Stewart. I thought he really did a tremendous job. This offensive line is going to have no issue blocking for whoever is back there. So I do feel like that is a good thing. Henderson is the best back in that backfield, but Sony Michel is very good. He did come in and run 4.8 yards per carry on 10 carries. So this is somebody that can definitely play. They also have Jake Funk, a guy that they, you know, really like, seventh round pick out of Maryland. Most curious I am, though, is not in Jake Funk, though. They did just sign Javian Hawkins to the practice squad. Was a fan of him coming out of Louisville. I think he can do a little bit of everything. And for people saying, well, he's just a UDFA, he's been cut twice and all that, this is what the Rams do. I mean, in case you haven't been paying attention, Darius Williams was a UDFA with the Ravens. Ravens, you know, cut him. They tried to get him on the practice squad. The Rams claimed him. The Rams have done this to Corey Littleton, UDFA Corey Littleton. They did this. Their long snapper was a waiver claim from the Titans. They do this all the time. And so, you know, that's the funny thing. It's like, for me, I'm not at all surprised that they went out and got a guy like Hawkins, because I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up having a role down the line. Malcolm Brown was a 2015 UDFA out of Texas. And coming out of high school, he was the number one, you know, recruit in the country at running back. But he was a UDFA out of Texas in 2015. He was actually with the St. Louis Rams. And he just left the Rams this year, went to Miami. So, I mean, that should really tell you. I mean, they really do not care how they get their talent. They'll find talent. They always do. And then that's a big thing there. I mean, last year with Austin Blythe playing, that's somebody that they, you know, acquired after the Colts dumped him. Austin Corbett, they traded. You know, he was the 33rd overall pick in his respective draft by the Browns. And they just gave the Browns like a late fifth round pick. And they're like, hey, we need him. And sure enough, he was a Ram. They have all sorts of means of acquiring talent. It's definitely impressive. Justin Hollins is another guy starting outside linebacker. The fifth round pick, Denver cuts him and they claim him. And now he's starting. So I think that's pretty much how I feel, is that, you know, Hawkins is somebody to keep an eye on, because if Henderson were to go down, you know, they have Buddy Howell as well in the practice squad, somebody that's played a lot on special teams, great special teamer, has some success as a running back, not a ton. But when you look at it, I mean, if Henderson goes down, I don't even know if they'll make another move, because I do think Hawkins would be really good in this offense.
Speaking of talent, obviously the Rams do have a lot of talent at the wide receiver position, Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods, but instant chemistry between Kupp and Stafford out of the gates. There's all sorts of stories. They're having breakfast together most days and BFFs off the field and all of that fun stuff. Robert Woods, a little bit of a slower start, has had some moments, but only 91 yards through the air so far. So for the longest time, like Kupp and Woods, there was an argument of 1A, 1B, you know, who's the number one wide receiver amongst them? Are they on the same level? Is this the year, though, that Kupp establishes himself as the clear-cut number one option in LA? Or is this just a slow start for Woods and he's going to turn it on in the weeks to come?
Great question. And, you know, part of me As someone that loves Robert Woods, well, I love Cooper Kupp too, but Robert Woods has been one of my favorite players for a while. And I always felt like he was a tick better than Cooper Kupp because of what he was able to do as just an all-around receiver. I thought he was a better blocker. And the fact is that he's got incredible vision where he could be literally used as a running back. But, you know, I do think Cooper Kupp is emerging as the number one receiver. It's not that I'm giving up on Woods, but it's just that I have not seen Stafford this reliant on, and I don't want to even say reliant. I don't even think that's the word. Mm-hmm. But looking for, or at least throwing to, the same receiver this much since Calvin Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have not. Marvin Jones is a guy he liked a lot, but when Marvin Jones, Kenny Golladay, Golden Tate, all of those guys are out there, Hawkinson, I didn't see him just solely focus on Marvin Jones or Hawkinson or Golden Tate or Kenny Golladay. Yeah. I mean, he seems very focused on just getting the ball to Kupp. And I mean, I can't really blame him. Right now, Cooper Kupp, I think if you could bet on it, I would not be surprised if he leads the league in receiving the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
They just have a crazy rapport, and we will see against Tampa, because I do think eventually, and this is the thing, is that teams will double Kupp, they'll bracket him, and it'll be funny because it'll be like, did you expect Stafford to still try and force his hand? I mean, he'll throw to Woods. He'll throw to Jefferson. He'll throw to Jackson. He'll throw to Higbee. I mean, he's not, you know, it's not like he's a guy that, like, he's not like Jared Goff, for instance, that would, you know, have his favorite receiver and have a hard time getting off him. Matthew Stafford knows how to spread the ball out. So that's the thing that makes this sustainable, is that the whole idea, well, what if they bracket Cooper Kupp, or what if they double him, or what if they triple him? And it's like, then he'll throw to Woods or Higbee or anybody, because this is just such a fantastic and a deep roster, and he's got a bevy of weapons where that won't even be an issue.
If we go to the flip side of the ball here and start focusing a little bit on the defense now, obviously Rams defense led by Aaron Donald, Jalen Ramsey, still among the league's best units. But as you were mentioning earlier, they lost some key role players on that defense, Rockers and Johnson, Hill, Fox, et cetera. So what kind of effect have these role player losses really had on the Rams defense through the first 2 weeks? Like, is there a position that's looking a little bit shaky right now that you've seen? And maybe what defensive player not named Donald or Ramsey has impressed you the most so far this season?
Well, I think the guy that really is impressing me the most besides, you know, Ramsey or Donald, you know, that would be Taylor Rapp. No one is talking about it. And it's really because if you think about it, secondary guys don't get called on unless you see them on screen, right? Because not everyone has time to watch all 22. Not everyone has access to all 22. And the broadcast view is like, it doesn't do any justice for the secondary. So Taylor Rapp, going back and watching the film, has just been a breath of fresh air, very comfortable in his safety role. The issue with him has been staying healthy. Last year didn't really get a chance to play a whole lot because he, once again, couldn't stay healthy. But 2019 is when he came in as a second round pick, a guy that the Rams had come out and said they were fine drafting at 31 to be their first overall pick or first round pick. And Taylor Rapp, he had a chance, in my opinion, that year. He started a little bit late because of Eric Weddle being there, but he had a chance to actually be a defensive player of the year. He had a phenomenal season in 2019. Unfortunately, they missed the playoffs, and he had a huge coverage gaffe against the 49ers that eliminated them. But he's only gotten better. And I kept hearing in camp that Taylor Rapp was just different. He was just a different animal this year, and I'm seeing it. He's been a lot more disciplined in coverage. Just think, the thing that hurt him was, you know, he ran a 4.7 at his pro day. And I think, like, everyone just assumed he wasn't fast. But the thing is that he wasn't, I believe he got hurt or something like that right before, and he ran anyway. He does not play like a 4.7 on tape. This is somebody that's got some pop behind his pads. This is somebody that, you know, is like a heat-seeking missile. But on top of that, we've been seeing some really good things at him in coverage. And I think, if anything, he started to overshadow last year's bright sixth rounder in Jordan Fuller. So Taylor Rapp has really impressed me. And I understand it's easier to play in a defense that has Jalen Ramsey, Darius Williams, and Aaron Donald. But Taylor Rapp has definitely turned some heads, I think, early on.
If we just look at the NFC West as a whole here, if you had to rank those three opponents in terms of who you would least like to face in the playoffs, like, how would you put that pecking order right now through 2 weeks of the season?
Well, right now, I would say right off the bat, I'd say Arizona is probably the team I'd want to face the least as of right now. Mm-hmm. I think what it will be at the end of the season is the Niners, because I think Trey Lance will be the starter and that defense is ferocious. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, if the Rams have any sort of offensive, they spin around on offense and they have any stalls like they did against the Colts, uncharacteristic stalls, then they're not going to, you know, they're going to have an issue against Kyler Murray and the Cardinals, who have been a high octane passing attack the first two games and showing that they really don't care how many times Kyler Murray's throwing the football. And obviously you have Dalton, you have Ramsey, that negates things a little bit, but I mean, good players are going to make good plays and, you know, he's still going to get his. And so I think right now, just off of what I've seen, I think Arizona would be one. I think San Francisco would be two and Seattle would be three. Seattle just doesn't scare me. I don't know what it is. They do not scare me. I think Seattle comes in last place in this division. They are, once again, in my opinion, it's Russell Wilson. I don't really like their offense so far. I mean, don't get me wrong, but Tyler Lockett is fun to watch, and he's been a model of consistency just like ever. But they have not been able to get DK Metcalf going early on the way they wanted to. They don't run the ball enough, so there's not enough – it's not a balanced enough attack for me to feel like it's a pick your poison approach. I feel like if you can stop the run, it's like, it doesn't matter because they give up on the run. You know, they don't establish the run, or if they do, they still don't continue to use it. And so then you look at the defense and you're like, yeah, there's some big names like Jamal Adams and Carlos Dunlap, but the defense doesn't really scare me either, you know? And so I look at the Seahawks is the least fierce, and down the road, probably still going to be the least fierce. And the Niners have this unlimited potential, because once Trey Lance is ready to go and they use him as their starter, crazy things can happen, because you look at what Garoppolo is doing right now. I mean, he hasn't been bad, but you take what Trey Lance can do with that and then add his running to the mix, he's just a whole different animal. He was my favorite quarterback coming out. So, you know, I definitely think the Niners at the end of the season, but right now I'd say the Cardinals. And then, you know, right now, as what we've seen, the Niners and then the Seahawks, and then down the road, as far as potential, it'd be the Niners, Cardinals, and Seahawks.
So last question before we let you go here. Aside from staying healthy, what would you say is the number one key to the Rams going on a deep playoff run this year?
I mean, yeah, obviously staying healthy is a good one. I think the biggest key here is just let Stafford be Stafford. And I think Sean McVay realizes that he's not going to get too cute. You know, he knows who Matthew Stafford is. They've had a great connection. The thing is, I think the best way to put it is that Sean McVay was just kind of over being a teacher. He didn't want a student anymore. He wanted a partner. And so I think it's kind of like the Stafford's like the executive producer, so to speak. And this is the film, and he's got a lot of leeway. He can say what he wants to do and all that. At the end of the day, you know, Sean McVay is directing the film. And so, you know, I do think having that input is definitely helpful, and mixing a lot of the same concepts they used with Jim Caldwell when Matthew Stafford was as comfortable as can be in that offense, you know, over in Detroit. Mixing those concepts with, you know, what Sean McVay wants to do, I think just really helped Stafford's learning curve. And also, let's call it like it is, Stafford is an incredibly intelligent quarterback. So I didn't think the learning curve was going to matter that much, but it has made it easier where you come in one off season, you learn this offense, you go out there and you just play your football game and you're 2-0 and you look great. Things are going well for the Rams. And I think really just you got to keep Stafford on his – let Stafford be Stafford. And on top of that, you look at the defense, you know, Raheem Morris right now through two games, His defense has allowed fewer points, fewer yards, has more sacks and more interceptions than Brandon Staley's did at this point last season. It's only two games. But aside from being healthy, the keys are for the Rams to get to the Super Bowl. Matthew Stafford continues to let him be him. And then I would say, looking at the defense, just continue to do what you're doing, but also realize this. You can't play 17 games because you will tire yourself out. You can't play 17 games of bend-no-break defense. It will wear on you. And I think the idea, obviously, with bend-no-break is you're trading a field goal for touchdowns because your offense is that good. You can do that. I do think, though, they could run into an issue. And, you know, we did see that a little bit in the Colts game. The defense was on the field for so long. The Colts were able to still drive the ball downfield and make plays, even despite the fact they stifled the run. So that's what I would say in regards to the keys to that.
Love the Hollywood reference there for Los Angeles. I mean, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and talk Rams. For those that are listening right now that want to tune in to any of your podcasts or check out any of your articles or anything like that, where are the best places to find you these days?
Yeah, you know, you can find me at JK Bogan on Twitter. I'm just going to be directing people over there instead of naming, you know, all the different things I'm doing. I have a YouTube channel. It's just my name, Jake Allen Bogan. I do 85% Ram stuff and then a bunch of NFL and MCU and horror movie content. So that's really it. Downtown Rams, my YouTube, and you can follow me at JK Bogan. All of my stuff is on there in my link tree. The link is in the bio there.
Beautiful. All right. Well, we appreciate your time. We'll see how the Rams fare. Obviously, a huge test for them this weekend, but we'll also be a good measuring stick to see exactly where they are in the NFL pecking order.
Absolutely.
And that's a wrap for another episode of the Dine Sports Podcast on the Dine Sports Podcast Network. As always, a huge thank you goes out to both of our guests today, Michaela and Jake, for sitting down and talking all things WNBA and Los Angeles Rams. If you like what you heard, make sure to like, comment, review, subscribe, share the episode with a friend. Check out our YouTube channel as well, too. We've got behind-the-scenes content going on there. Just search Dine Sports, and you can see some of the YouTube exclusive footage that we've got going on, sneak peeks and deep dives on all your favorite sports subjects. So check that out today. Until next time, folks, stay safe. We'll see you in a bit.